Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. It's got all 230 or so of our previous episodes. We most recently talked about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Seinfeld, Sicario, and I wrote a thing about Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden's movies. Yeah, follow us on Twitter if you're so inclined. We tweet very rarely, but they're great when we tweet. Yeah, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
All right.
That theme song is a bit moodier than what we're used to.
I'm a little scared. Yeah. Those bells are far too tubular for me.
I just found out the name of that today, and it made me really happy.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay, also, right off the top, let's just get the Christopher Nolan mention out of the way, because I've got to find a way to work it into every podcast. That sounds like the music from Interstellar sounds so much like that tubular bells song to me. Like, from very key moments in Interstellar, it sounds like they're playing off of that.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I imagine he was probably influenced by this movie in some way.
Yeah, by casting Ellen Burstyn.
For one. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And then treating her character like shit, basically. Matthew McConaughey shows up. Okay, bye, Ma. Or kid. Sorry, daughter. Leaves. Anyway, not what we're talking about. We're talking about a 40 years past version of Ellen Burstyn.
Yes.
Yeah. The Exorcist.
Yes. Which, as you said, 1973.
Yep.
And as you said before we hit the big record button, directed by William Friedkin.
Billy.
And reinforcing everything I believe about him in researching this movie, he seems crazy.
Oh, dude's a lunatic. Here, I'm going to read you a quote from Peter Biskin's Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is a very good book. But it's after he had just won the Oscar for The French Connection. On the cloth back of his director's chair, to the left of his name was stenciled an Oscar for The French Connection. To the right of his name was the outline of another Oscar with a question mark inside it. So that's who we're dealing with on the set of The Exorcist.
Yeah, yeah, he is kind of a bit of a loose cannon.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're right. I mean, he did direct The French Connection, which was received very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is still widely regarded as a very good movie. So he is talented, seemingly. He knows what he's doing. He just has a very kind of unorthodox and at times extremely confrontational and unpleasant manner of making movies, it seems.
Yeah, and he really kind of fit into the period that way. Like, Peter Bogdanovich and Barbara Felsen are two other directors that were unquestionably talented that kind of were dicks, and it ended up hurting their career a lot, you know. And the same thing happened to a lesser extent with William Friedkin, but it definitely happened to William Friedkin, definitely partially because of his rage issues, which are well documented.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those movies that has a documentary all about the making of it, which I've never seen, but I've kind of read a lot of excerpts from it lately just in researching this movie. And yeah, a lot of stuff about, not even just that he had a kind of a short fuse, but when he had time to come up with ideas, he often came up with very, let's say, difficult to deal with ones, such as, firing guns on set to get actors scared enough to fit into the role, which actors don't like, because not only are you saying they can't do their jobs without these extreme measures, you're also shooting a gun by their ear,
exactly.
Which no one likes. So yeah, he, as we said, French Connection, and he clearly is a talented filmmaker. And one thing that I kind of think it's kind of lost in talking about horror movies in general is that this was, a very big deal of a horror movie leading up to it. I mean, you mentioned Peter Bogdanovich, who, was considered for this, and Stanley Kubrick. And Friedkin had already done The French Connection. Mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of had a lot of heat. And
well, I think the French Connection puts him in this conversation, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's based on a best-selling book. It had a huge budget, had a huge ad campaign, and, you know, had some big stars and a very hot director at the time. So it's not just that this movie, you know, came out looking good and now it kind of is revered. It was kind of a hot property even before it had come out, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the second it does come out, it's like this cultural sensation. Ellen Burstyn talks about it. I think she was in Montreal at the time or watching a news report of something in Montreal where people are just lined up outside the theater at 4 a.m. on opening day, which is crazy. You know, like it was had a lot of hype leading into it, and certainly the financial success of it is reflective of that.
Yeah, and adjusted for inflation, it's still one of the most successful movies ever. I mean, it made a lot of money, especially for the 70s. And just that it kind of was a big project at the time. They kind of knew they had something big on their hands here. Definitely probably didn't know how big it was going to be, but knew that this was kind of something to be taken very seriously.
Yeah, exactly, which is how William Friedkin was able to get away with some of the things that he did get away with. Like, I think the shooting schedule was initially supposed to be 85 days, and it ended up being around 224 or something.
Yep.
Like that.
Yep.
You know, the only way you're kind of able to get away with that is if the people that are paying for those extra 100-some-odd days are going to make their money back and then some, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. It made a lot of money. And as you said, it was kind of a big cultural sensation and was all over the news. And I think that was a combination of a very well-funded ad campaign as well as it being a very abrasive, like very genuinely different and harsh kind of movie. So I think that it was fueled by having a lot of money and having a lot of support for what we said was a pretty big project. But also, it is a successful movie. I think it's a well put together movie. And it also just also has the shock value. Mm-hmm. Even if this wasn't a well put together movie, there would be some things about it on the news just because of the things that are shown and the things that are said in this movie, often by a 12-year-old girl. So it did have kind of a lot of things going for it. It did have kind of the very loud, sexy kind of, you know, spectacle things to it. But it also was, as we said, a big project with talented people behind and in front of the lens.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, you know, we've said it's one of the most successful horror movies, one of the most successful R-rated movies. And, you know, we kind of touched on what a cultural phenomenon it was. And yeah, I just think that it can't be overstated that this was just kind of taken as a very serious movie. And, you know, 10 Academy Award nominations, 2 wins. And I think just kind of made horror a genre, you know, that kind of had to be respected a little bit more. There's still that B-movie slasher part of horror, but this being nominated for Best Picture, this being made by, you know, William Friedkin, being a very revered director at that time, kind of elevated the whole genre.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree with that. And one of the things, I had never seen this movie before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. One of the things that really surprised me about this movie was that it's like, I mean, it's got all the elements of a prestige picture and then all the fucked up shit with Linda Blair, you know, like,
yeah.
It's got like mothers and daughters and mothers and sons and religion and Hollywood. It's got so many elements that are a quick way to Oscar nominations.
Yep.
And then it just also has that really sensational aspect to it as well. So, that was the stuff that surprised me about the movie, because obviously I had heard plenty about the horror aspects of it, but all of the stuff, I mean, especially like the first 45 minutes, there's just nothing particularly horrific going on. But yeah, all that stuff really surprised me, and I definitely understood a lot more and very quickly how it got nominated for so many Oscars, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it there, that it is something that you hear about a lot. It was just such a big moment. Like, the movie was so big, and there are so many those sensational scenes are so easily spoofed and things like that. So you do see them kind of within pop culture. But yeah, there is a whole other movie going on that's not just the exorcism sequences of this movie, which is pretty late by the time our titular exorcist shows up.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, shows up in Georgetown.
Right, yeah.
But agreed entirely. You know, it's... I think, you know, if we're looking at percentages, this movie's more of a drama, like more of the screen time is just sort of a drama about a mother caring about her daughter than it is these horrific sort of things.
Yeah.
Although there's a lot of the hospital stuff is totally horrifying, despite not really being the sort of exorcist type stuff, you know?
Yeah, I know. And that was something I was definitely going to bring up, is that that's so much of that is what I think is the real strength of this movie. And maybe it could have made a lot of money and been a cultural sensation like it was without kind of that stuff at the front, more of the stuff about Chris, Ellen Burstyn's character, and, you know, her relationship with her daughter before she's, you know, what appears to be entirely possessed.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really strong stuff in there, and it's not exactly horror in the traditional sense, but it's, you know, it's very horrific, very heavy, very... you know, worrying stuff about watching something happen to your child or, you know, seemingly to any loved one. And just this idea of Chris being, you know, she's a successful actress, it seems. She seems very wealthy. And she has what seems to be a very good relationship with her daughter. And it's just kind of watching her helplessness of not knowing what to do, what's the next step, and just all these moments of frustration of, you know, paying 80 doctors to try to get to the bottom of what's happening to your child and not being able to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, just one of the moments that really gets me in this movie is just when they say they might have to do that surgery again because nothing's showing up, and kind of that futility of having your daughter go through these, you know, awful things. And the procedures shown in this movie are accurate. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, surgeries and things that did exist and ways to try to diagnose mental illnesses, those spinal taps and those big loud machines, those are all medically accurate for the time. And just, you know, it's not Satan, you know, it's not a kind of like a hellish demon scare at that point. It's not, you know, particularly violent in a confrontational violence kind of way, but it's just, it's so unsettling. And that moment when you see the blood kind of spray out of her neck while she's on the doctor's table,
mm-hmm.
that was one of the moments that got a lot of people. I mean, you heard about this movie making people throw up in the theaters or having them, you know, run out of the screenings or just faint in the middle of the movie. And that was one of the moments that really got the most people from what I've read and heard. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it just came.
Well, it's probably the most repulsive moment in the movie to me, for sure.
It's really gross, and
disgusting.
And I'm not someone who's weird about like doctors or blood, but it is just it's really, really gross. And
yeah.
I just think that, you know, as you said, there are the parts of this movie that get talked about and you know, kind of parodied a lot, but there is a whole other movie there, and I think that it needs to be stated how important that part of the movie is, and mm-hmm. that is responsible for so many of the kind of negative feelings that come with watching this movie.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, a big part of the reason why that is even more affecting than the stuff that comes later is, or viscerally affecting, I suppose, than the stuff that comes later is because, you know, pretty much everybody, like, it just exists more in a reality that we understand immediately, you know, whereas when we get to the exorcism scene, it's a lot of things we've never seen before, you know,
yeah.
Or like in any context. I mean, we haven't experienced that procedure, but we understand what hospitals are, you know, and that these types of machines exist. And that could be our neck. And it's just disgusting.
Yeah. And from Chris's perspective, just having having someone else go through it and kind of just that feeling of helplessness where, oh, we're going to do this awful surgery again, or we spent all this time and money and we still don't know what's wrong with your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I understand that it was kept under wraps that Linda Blair wasn't solely responsible for the voices and the look of Regan?
She gets called, like, she, I believe the correct pronunciation, because that's how her and her mother say it, is Regan, but a doctor calls her Regan a couple of times
okay.
in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is a touch I actually really liked. You know, because that's something that would happen.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, they had, you know, some people fill in for her and fill in for her voice at different times, and they weren't given credit for it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that's one of the things that they did intentionally to make it seem, even knowing that this is a movie, that a 12-year-old girl is even capable of this as an actress, you know, to do these things and to make her voice sound the way they did. And there's a one of the women who does the voice is named Mercedes McCambridge, and she's a radio legend, and kind of provides that really raspy, really unsettling demon voice for Reagan throughout the movie. And I just thought that was interesting that even knowing that, you know, this isn't a documentary, they still try to reinforce that this can happen to kids, like, or kids are able to kind of reach this state and make these noises, even if that wasn't true. It was just kind of part of the allure and the legend of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do you like this movie overall?
I like it. I am not, like, I wasn't over the moon about it, but certainly really well made. Like, and one of the things I found really interesting about it from a filmmaking perspective was the fact that it's so different visually from The French Connection. Like, I mean, we did a podcast about it, but what made The French Connection so interesting and distinct was the sort of more verite aspects of the filmmaking, where it was the actors famously didn't have marks that they had to hit. It was just sort of a camera operator was told to follow them and just sort of figure it out, you know, as they go along. Whereas this is a much more composed picture in general.
Oh, yeah.
And some really nice dollies, and just in general, very little handheld, like pretty much the exact opposite of how Friedkin did The French Connection. And I think The Exorcist is a wonderfully directed movie. And I think I really appreciate when directors, especially coming off their biggest success, do something totally different stylistically. Like, I mean, that's what I appreciate so much about Soderbergh. All of his movies look so different, you know, and just because he's willing to try different things. And there aren't a lot of directors that will do that. And that's something that I really enjoy about William Friedkin's career in general. You know?
Yeah, it's right off the bat in this movie. All that stuff that's shot at the archaeological site in Iraq at the beginning. I think that's all really well composed. And it's you know, as you said, it's so much different than The French Connection. It's really stylized. You can tell that it's really thought out technically where everything's going to be. I mean, that shot of the kid running, and then we get the shot of the priest through the kid's legs, you know, that's just well put together. And it's a lot of long shots and some still cameras and just some really good kind of patient filmmaking, which isn't what The French Connection did and, you know, what skyrocketed him to the level of fame he was at after it. And as you said, he does something different, but he does that very well. So that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there are more marks in the opening sequence of this movie than there are in the entirety of The French Connection.
Yes, absolutely. So do you want to...
You like this movie as well, right?
Yeah, I do. I saw it in theaters on the re-release there.
Yeah, the version you had never seen until you saw it.
And you know what? I think it's the only version I've ever seen, even though I've seen this movie a few times.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the only version that is really easy to get a hold of anymore.
Yeah.
I think most people that are seeing this movie for the first time now are going to see that version.
Right. And did you see what the differences were?
No. I saw a list of them and was just like, I'm just not going to read them.
Okay.
Partially for time, but also because, I mean, this is the movie that I saw, so.
Yeah.
And the movie that William Friedkin wants us to see, so, you know.
Yeah, it seems that way. Mm-hmm. And I know one of the scenes that was taken out originally was just something that he wanted in there, and then they shot it, and they just couldn't make it look right with the technology they had at the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was the one where Linda Blair comes down the stairs.
Yeah, that spider walk sequence, as they say.
Yeah.
I guess there were some wires that you could just see much too plainly.
Yeah, the nerds could spot it.
Yeah, exactly. And so that that scene was just eliminated, and then as digital technology progressed and they could eliminate those wires, they put it back in. And I think that scene's really good. I think that's kind of one of the images that sticks with you from this one. So I'm glad it's in there now.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It's really creepy.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm probably on record on this podcast of not being a huge fan of directors going back and retouching their work. Unless, you know, something was taken away from them by the studio or something, like say something like Blade Runner. Blade Runner is a good example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, an exception that proves my rule for sure, you know, because the movie is definitely helped by the existence of that scene.
Yeah. And there's one other, I mean, there's several differences that I won't get into all of them here, but there's that scene of, Karis, and what's the older priest's name? Max
von Sydow. I don't remember his name. It's something okay. Like Merriman, but not that. Merrin? Merrin, maybe?
Yes, that
something
is right.
Yeah. It's close.
Lancaster Merrin is
oh,
if I remember. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, it's the scene, one of the moments that happens kind of... I don't know, at halftime of one of the exorcisms, I guess, because that exorcism
that's
goes
a good
on
way
for
of describing it. Yeah,
I think in Catholic terms, that's what they use.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's that moment where they're
Roger Goodell is also Pope.
Right. Yeah. It's a moment where they're discussing outside of Reagan's room why a demon would choose a 12-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's a question a lot of people really would ask is, you know, if you want to do damage to the world, why not pick someone older and stronger? But I love that scene. I think that scene where they discuss about just trying to force people to lose hope and to eliminate the idea that anything is pure and good in the world is what the demon is up to. I think that's a really good scene, and I think it's really important to the movie because it does answer the question why Reagan, and it answers not really answers, but kind of speaks to Karis's journey about his way that he's lost faith throughout mm-hmm. the movie, mm-hmm. especially at the beginning, obviously. And I think that's a really strong part. I do like his plot line. And the idea of anyone losing their faith, I think, can be interesting. But for it to be a priest and, you know, losing your faith, you've kind of lost your whole purpose in life. I think that's an interesting storyline. I think it leaves him in such a weird place. And it's just his proximity to... you know, the McNeil family, just the fact that he works at the university, that they're shooting this student protest movie, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And that's how he gets tied into the story. I really like that a lot. And I just like that he has, you know, a well-rounded character throughout this movie. And yeah, I think that scene really adds a lot to that.
Yeah, I would agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I concur, Doctor.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else did you want to talk about with The Exorcist?
I really liked the thing that I enjoyed the most about the movie, specifically because I don't know that it was necessarily intended to be part of it, was the way I think that it kind of shows a relationship between a mother and a daughter at a time where that relationship is its most difficult to, or starting to become its most difficult to maintain, right? So we get the at the beginning, you know, we get Reagan as this very childlike sort of girl, right? And she's 12, so she's just about to go through puberty, and the relationship she has with her mother is very much it's pretty ideal. It seems like they really get along with each other, and Reagan is the seemingly ideal sort of daughter. She's talking about horses and all the stuff that is very like stereotypical child. Like, I want a horse. Obviously, you're a kid. That's what kids want for some reason, you know. Yep. And the way that the movie sort of, as you've discussed quite a bit, the shows that Ellen Burstyn sort of being taken away from understanding who this person is. And seeing her as this monster, you know, like as she starts to basically go through puberty. And I think it sort of works for as a metaphor for this person going through their teenage years and how there really can be this barrier between you and your parents through no fault of anybody's, just because like that's just the way the teenage years work, you know? And you used to be totally understandable to your parents, and then you just turn into this monster that does all these crazy things. And your mom is looking at you from behind this glass and not totally understanding what you're doing, you know, or what is happening to you and all these things. And I think it's telling that there's that moment with Ellen Burstyn in the doctor's office initially where the doctor doesn't want to say what Reagan said to him, you know, because I forget the exact sentence, but it definitely involves the C word. But when Ellen Burstyn finds out what it is, she starts chuckling like, haha, isn't it funny that my daughter said this? But it's just the beginning, you know, like it's going to get way worse. And then towards the end of the movie, obviously Reagan's still 12 at the end of the movie, but I think it sort of shows this more, you know, the teenager stops being a monster and calms down and is able to be identified as her daughter again, you know, somebody that she's able to get along with and share warm feelings with again, you know?
Yeah, no, she has that line, you know, that thing up there is not my daughter. Like, it's...
Mm-hmm. Which is, yeah, something that could be said about, you know, a 16-year-old daughter that just came home from a dance, torn up or something. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that part where that you were describing between Chris and the doctor is a really well-done part of the movie that I really like a lot. Mm-hmm. And... you know, the doctor's kind of just dancing around and saying, you know, she's got quite a mouth on her, you know, and it's, Chris is kind of laughing, just saying, oh, I wonder what my daughter said. And then she said, keep your fingers away from my goddamn cunt.
Yes.
Yeah, there it is. And, yeah, she does kind of giggle for a bit, but then there's like very quickly this moment where it's off. Like she really can't believe that that's what happened. And, yeah, to try to think of her daughter as someone who would be capable of saying that, it just seems so – you can really get the sense that it's so nonsensical to her. Like that – it just doesn't sound right. It's just not adding up. And I really like that part. Yeah, and it's that kind of distance that does develop. And obviously this is just a very extreme example of it. But I think that's a great part, and one of the things that is the backbone of this movie is their relationship.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, also just in general, the child to parent relationship runs heavily throughout this movie. I mean, the Karis, I forget how to pronounce it. Yeah, him and his mother obviously is a nice, you know, addition to that. That he loses faith because his mother dies. I do think that is the theme running through this movie that I find the most interesting, the parental to child relationship.
Yeah, and something else that I think is really prevalent in this movie, it sounds obvious in a movie called The Exorcist, which is a very famously about an exorcism, but there's this theme of getting rid of something that is everywhere through this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, Karis wants his mom out of the house. The leaves are even falling from the trees. Like it all takes place in autumn. Chris wants to get the rats out of the attics. The movie she's filming, that whole speech is about getting the military off campus. Early on, we see Chris pulling on an unlit cigarette, which to me just strikes me as someone trying to get rid of a cigarette addiction and kind of weeding off it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's all very obvious that this movie is about getting something out of something else. But the way that is pretty delicately leaned on in the first 15, 20 minutes, I think is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's never spelled out very clearly, but there's all these little examples of things being fixed or things being removed from something else and how it's all going to be better. But it's just the grind of doing that. And obviously it's played out in a very big way in that final, exorcism scenes, I guess, because they kind of have a few sessions at it. But it's a really, really big theme that you can kind of see in everything from, you know, set design to throwaway lines to when this movie was filmed and just even a speech of the movie within the movie, which is so tangential to the plot. But, it's cool that there is that kind of thematic through line to the whole film. I thought that was really interesting and I hadn't noticed it before.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree. And the thing I like about the fact that Chris is an actress and all that stuff, and a successful one at that, I mean, it's, like you said, very tangential to the movie, but just the fact that she has what, especially in 1973, what you would view as an ideal life, right? And you've got to remember this is 40 years ago, so it's, we know much less about celebrities than we do now, and you know what their actual real life is like, right? And so from an outsider looking in, it's like, oh, she's a famous actress, you know, her life has got to be perfect, and she does have these very ideal aspects to her life, like her house is beautiful, she's got service staff, and she's got a very nice daughter, but this happens to her daughter, and also she her relationship with the child's father is like, they're no longer together. So I mean, there's problems in every aspect of life, even people that are quote unquote living an ideal life, and especially for 1973, I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And speaking of films, I think just kind of to put this in a context as well, this was part of a cycle in the 60s and 70s of, you know, the demonic child, you know, subgenre of horror. And, you know, you mentioned films, and you mentioned that, you know, this is that era, the early 70s, you know, movies like Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, things like that. There was a lot of this handled in a few different ways, but this idea of, you know, this evil child, this offspring of yours being something so alien and so so awful. Did you give any thought to that in kind of the social context?
No, not really. I can see where you're going with it for sure.
Okay, where am I going with it?
Well, I think it's just kind of like the anti sort of Vietnam sentiment and the protesting of the youth and whatnot of the time. That you are more well-versed in than I am. So I feel like it's just better if you talk about it than me.
No, I mean, that's kind of it. Obviously in every generation, you can have a movie about not understanding your kid. And as we said, I think that's something we both feel that this movie does well. Yeah. And there's kind of the Vietnam thing, the 60s, 70s in particular, I think was just such a radical time for youth. Like they were so much different than their parents in a very, very obvious and meaningful way, especially socially. So just the idea of your kids acting out with all these, the student protests and just your morals not lining up with your child's at all. Mm-hmm. I think is the theme that gets thrown around here, but it's also around the time that, like the pill is released, that form of contraception. Mm-hmm. So there's all these things, just in reading about the way this movie is perceived and kind of that whole little subgenre of the, you know, evil child that I was just mentioned a few minutes ago. Now that sex isn't just sex for, reproduction, which obviously it hadn't always been up until then, but this was just a very, the pill was kind of this very big touchstone for that. What results now? Have we completely perverted, you know, sex and the family and children by putting this chemical into her body? And, you know, what's going to happen now? What birth defects, which things like that, how's that going to kind of be illustrated in our children? And I think that's a big part of why that subgenre is viewed as being particularly popular around that time. I mean, that it happens all the time. One movie comes out and you try to emulate it because it was successful. But there's also just the idea that certain subgenres and certain themes and ideas show up over and over in a relatively small time frame because of something that's happening socially. And I think that The Exorcist fits into that because, you know, we see kind of all the touchstones of it. We see the evil children. We see some very, very unpleasant depictions of sexuality and sex. I mean, people often say the masturbation scene, but I think that's not the right word for what she does to herself with that crucifix.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, shoving her mother's face into her bloody crotch. And, like, there's all this just these very, very unpleasant sexualized images throughout this movie. And I think that just kind of goes in with this idea of that kind of immoral view of sex that came as a result of wide use of the contraceptive pill.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Anything else on this one?
I kind of like, it's something I like about the movie that I don't think necessarily ties in thematically. It's just kind of, it's a thing William Friedkin kind of did. He definitely did it in The French Connection and his follow-up movie Sorcerer, which is a really fascinating movie production-wise.
Okay. And,
like, it's fascinating to watch, too. Like, it's a good movie. Yeah. It had the bad luck of opening, like, Star Wars opens May 1977, Sorcerer early June 1977, and it was sort of like this real clear, we're done with you auteurs moment, you know? Like The Exorcist comes off the heels, and I'll get back to my point about the beginning of this movie eventually, but The Exorcist comes a year later than The Godfather, right? And The Godfather, I mean, I still think it's one of the best movies ever made, but it was also this huge blockbuster type of success, right? And so it was this combination of things that had been building up, starting in the late 60s with Bonnie and Clyde, as we talked about, and The Graduate that came out the same year, where the sort of French New Wave is kind of crossing over to American filmmaking. We're getting out of the studio system. And this is also what allows William Friedkin to exist, this change in Hollywood styles. But yeah, The Godfather is sort of the crossover of big business and the auteur filmmaking, where Francis Ford Coppola made a really, really great movie that was also extremely popular. Yeah. And that's basically what also happened with The Exorcist. And it's still this very auteurist film. And it's still well made and has a very strong, distinctive directorial voice behind it. But it was also a huge hit, which ended up kind of being in William Friedkin's detriment, because in 1975 you get Jaws, which is another auteurist movie that is also a blockbuster. And then 1977 you get Star Wars, which is like the exclamation mark on that sentence. And yeah, it kind of just turned the auteurist element of it ends up getting lost to the spectacle, which is really representative in Star Wars, which is a well directed movie, but is still leans much more heavily on spectacle than any of the previous three movies that I mentioned. And Sorcerer was still this very spectacular film, but also a very auteurist film. It was like off the success of The Exorcist, Friedkin can do whatever he wanted. You know, we talk about these movies all the time. Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Nolan doing Inception, Paul Thomas Anderson doing The Master. Like, these are movies that may or may not be the best that these directors do, but it's the most pure version of a movie that they want to make at that time, because they have the most control that they've ever had in their career because of their previous successes. And Sorcerer is fascinating from that perspective. One of the things I really enjoy about The Exorcist is the opening, and how we have these three disparate things, like people that we're introduced to. You know, we've got Max von Sydow in Iraq, we've got Ellen Burstyn, and we've got Karis. And
Jason Miller?
Yeah, Jason Miller.
Yeah.
We don't know how these people are gonna come together. We assume that they will. But it doesn't happen quickly at all. And no. Especially in the case of Max von Sydow. But I find it really interesting that sort of like really off-putting is the wrong word, but that type of bringing your characters together sort of thing was done because it's so oblique for so long, you know?
Yeah.
And The French Connection has that at the beginning, and Sorcerer is that times 10. Like, the first hour of Sorcerer, you have no idea what the hell is going on. And I found that really interesting about The Exorcist, particularly since it was a movie that was so popular, and I just didn't know what was really happening for the first 20 minutes. You know, I didn't know how these things were going to intersect. Like, I had no idea this movie was going to start in Iraq. I was not prepared for that. And that sequence goes on for quite a while. And I loved it because of
very
that.
Little dialogue, too.
Yeah, exactly. I loved that I had no idea what was happening. I love that that can happen in a movie that is also, as you said, adjusted for inflation, one of the most popular movies ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and there's a couple moments where you are sort of left in the dark more than I thought you would be in this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And some interesting kind of plot things that I think I forget about every time I watch the movie, and once I'm done with it, and then I watch it again. Just some of the things about Karis, you know, the fake holy water, testing if she knows his mom's maiden name and things like that. Like, there is that question for a while of, is she really possessed, or is this just some kind of, like, is she just acting out in a very, very extreme way?
Yeah.
And it puts you in sort of Chris's position as well, of just not knowing what's happening and really wanting to know and really wanting to be able to understand. But, you know, it kind of being not entirely explained. It's not just, you don't just see a demon go into Reagan and then you're like, okay, well, now we know. And it's, you know, Von Sydow finds a statue, and then Reagan, you know, embarrasses herself by peeing at this party that her mom's having. There's just all these weird things that it's really not adding up right away. And mm-hmm. I think that that's something that probably wouldn't be done as much anymore, but I think is very effective when it is done in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. And especially not in a blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the I was trying to think of a movie, like the most, the closest modern comparison that I could come up with for The Exorcist, or that style of movie, and it being received as a popular movie. And I mean, the closest thing I could come up with was Black Swan, which, you know, isn't even that good of a comparison. There are definitely some things that line up, but Black Swan was nowhere near the hit that The Exorcist was, of course.
Yeah, it was received well critically, but it didn't, I mean, Exorcist just made so much money.
Well, for the movie that Black Swan is, it made a ton of money.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, all things considered, like, that was a pretty big success.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, speaking of movies where directors have a lot of control to do whatever they want, Aronofsky's Noah comes because of Black Swan's success, yeah. You know? So, yeah, that was the closest thing I could come up with. But even that made a pretty small cultural dent, you know, like it was a thing that everybody was talking about for a while, but it certainly wasn't The Exorcist, you know?
Yeah, no, a Black Swan costume in 2015 seems a lot less relevant than a Exorcist costume in 2015, even given the time lapse, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, speaking of modern times, what do you think would have been the reaction if this movie came out today? Like, do you think, because you want to say that things are always getting, you know, less strict and people care less about violence and, you know, sacrilege in movies. But I don't know if it's as easy as that. Like, what would happen if someone released a huge movie? And I know that movies like this exist in small pockets, but I mean, a huge movie from Warner Brothers, you know, a very major studio, lots of big money, big names, huge ad campaign, as we said, all these things. And we have a 12-year-old girl saying the things that Reagan says in this movie and doing things to herself and others that takes place in The Exorcist.
Well, I mean, I think there's very little in this movie that a direct, like, you know, Gus Van Sant's Psycho sort of remake would have to change. You know, like, there's not a lot in it that you couldn't remake shot for shot, right? You'd have to add in cell phones and change some of the medical technology, but for the most part, it's pretty timeless that way.
But I mean, from a taste perspective,
yeah, exactly. I'm just saying, like, just to sort of lead into, like, if the modern version of this exact film was to be made today, there'd be loud backlash for sure. I mean, even if we're to say that Warner Brothers lets a movie like this be released today, which, for the record, would not happen. They like a movie on the, you know, a comparable budget, would have way more people to appease, and would be much less, I don't know, might be more grotesque, but in a different way, you know?
Yeah.
You know, less thoughtful grotesqueness and way more just straight up grotesqueness.
More puke, less Jesus talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there would definitely be a backlash, because there's backlash to everything, you know? I think, I don't even know that it would necessarily be a hit, you know?
Yeah, well, that's not to say that this movie didn't receive any backlash.
Yeah, oh, it got plenty.
It most certainly did.
Yeah.
But just the idea of some of these things being said now, which it just seems counterintuitive because it seems like everyone cares less about everything now.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like everybody cares less about everything now, but a lot of people care way more about a lot of things now, too. Like people just sort of the whole outrage culture thing, and people just like being mad about stuff.
Yes. So. Well, yeah. And I mean, I think fewer people are going to church, but I think the people who are going to church still take it very seriously. And it just becomes less common to be kind of casually religious, which is what maybe you know, someone who is casually religious might be fine with this movie. But the people who are, you know, very religious, I think, would see this as, you know, just a sign of how different things are now. The fact that, you know, this can be in a blockbuster, but it was back then. It was in such a huge movie.
Mm-hmm.
So it would just be interesting if this movie didn't exist, what people would say now about just some of the completely, you know, I mean, I don't care personally, but they're just some completely vile things in this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's not even, like, that's putting it delicately, I feel. Yeah. So it's also, speaking of taste in movies, mm-hmm. what do you make of the cop and his whole plot line, which I think is always forgotten about.
Yeah.
And his,
I mean, I watched this movie last night and then watched it again this morning and forgot about him in the time in between. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I have no take on him. I think it's just some weird sort of cops have a hard time making friends sort of thing. Like, I don't know. That's the best reading I can come up with on it.
Yeah, no,
because I do not understand it. So I definitely put some time into thinking about it this afternoon.
Yeah, no, I don't really have a particular take on all the movie talk and why we're left with his scene as one of the final ones, or the final one, really. But I do kind of, I like his character, and I like the way that the cops and the doctors are really handled in this movie, I think, adds to it a lot. Him, you know, having to have a part of it because someone died. You know, it seems like in a sloppier movie, what the cop isn't, you know, totally important to the actual exorcism, so why have them? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, no, in the real world, if someone dies, you know, that's, you can't just say, no, we've got this religious thing, don't worry about it. Exactly. No, I think that's good. And I really like the way that the subject of exorcism is even broached initially. It's by one of the doctors, and he mm-hmm. kind of treats it as this placebo effect that he's hoping for. He's saying, you know, there's nothing real about what you know, the Catholic Church or the priest is saying, but if your daughter believes these things, then maybe we can kind of trick her psychologically into not acting like this anymore. And it ties in with you know, Karis's use of the fake holy water and things like that. There is kind of that element of taking it from that real place of being a movie about Chris and her daughter being these very, you know, real, normal people with a healthy relationship, and making it into a horror movie. And I think that part of the movie before the exorcism even starts is just handled really well, and we kind of slide into it. And the idea of the exorcism even coming up the first time is really handled as kind of a joke that Chris isn't finding very funny, but the doctor is just so out of ideas that this is presented as somewhat of a last resort, but a decent option. Mm-hmm. I just think it's handled very seriously and just introduced into the film in a very realistic way, because I don't know. I just always think that jump is going to be silly about how these non-religious people, you know, go all out for this exorcism, but I think it's handled really well.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Okay.
Yeah. There's one shot late in the movie that I'm curious to know if you had a take on it. It's right when Reagan and Chris are leaving, and the father comes to say goodbye to them, and leaving the house, leaving Georgetown.
Okay.
Like the very end of the movie, and Ellen Burstyn talks to him for a minute, and then she gets in the car, and Reagan is just sort of staring at him for a second, and we get a shot from her perspective, and she is looking at pretty much like the focus of the shot is the priest, minister? I don't know. Which one is it?
Priest.
Priest? Okay. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm a heathen.
It's all Catholic all over this movie.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I just don't even know which one is which. The priest's collar. And so like we're getting his head is like cut off and we're basically just seeing his all black coat and the focus of the shot is the white square on his collar. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
It's interesting because we don't see a lot of stuff from Reagan's perspective.
We see very little. Yeah.
Like that might be it.
Yeah.
No, it's good. It's not particularly about that shot, but I like the ending. Just the fact that we do get that POV from her and it's not something that happens often. I just kind of get this tiny feeling that it's saying that there's something still inside of her. Mm. And the way that she kisses him and then goes away, it's not sexual at all, but there's something too intimate about it. Like the fact that she remembers none of it. I mean, it's not that it wouldn't make sense for her to be that grateful. But there was always just kind of this idea, and because there's so little dialogue after that, there's just this idea that there's still something in her, like there still is this darkness. And I think that's the focus of that shot that you were describing, kind of looking at this collar. It's the same way that she couldn't, you know, look at a crucifix or feel holy water. It just still has that power, that there's still something inside of her and she can't see this person as a person. She sees them as a priest because that's, you know, they're locked in this eternal struggle between good and evil. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that the shot is used so, the POV is used so sparingly in this movie from any character. I think it really adds a lot of gravity to that one. And I love that it's not in a, you know, we'll get our Christopher Nolan mention it again. It's not an Inception-like kind of super ambiguous ending where a movie ends and everyone kind of is asking the same question. It's not leaned on. It's not very heavy-handed at all. It's just this really small thing, and that's really what I love about it. And I think it's a really good note to leave on. It's just unsettling enough that it's not ham-fisted or setting up a sequel or anything like that, but it just kind of leaves you, you know, leaving the theater, leaving your viewing with your mind still kind of active.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing I agree with you. And the thing I like specifically about that shot is that, I mean, just physically in the shot, there's just so much darkness and a tiny sliver of light, you know, a tiny sliver of white. And I think it's kind of representative of what we see in the movie, what you and I have both talked about, you know, to an extent that, life is a bunch of darkness with little pieces of light in it. And, you know, you kind of accept the darkness to get to the light. And at that moment, she's able to focus on the light because things are good for her right now. And she's got her relationship with her mom back. And I think that that's kind of a really nice note for her almost final note in the movie. And I think it's really cool. And the fact that it's such a quick insert shot that I think has so much meaning in it is really fascinating. Like there was a shot like this in Bridge of Spies as well that I found really interesting. That's on screen for maybe a second tops, you know, and just gets a lot of meaning across, you know?
Yeah. And as we see in this movie that it can be very hard to find that light. I mean, this exorcism seems to go on for a long time and they take breaks and it just keeps going.
They take a halftime.
Yeah, they take a halftime. There's a halftime.
Al Pacino comes in to give a speech.
No, it's just
exorcisms
like
exorcisms are about inches.
There is just so much work that goes into kind of focusing on the good things in life and that the evil things can be so powerful, but there is very powerful good as well. It just takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
be sure to check back on iTunes. Follow or subscribe to us on iTunes. Search the MacGuffin. Hit the subscribe button. And yeah, we'll be back with our next episode.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.